This is Jonathan Bernstein conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Gary Franklin. The date is November 1st, 2001, at approximately 3:20 p.m. We are in the Special Collections Library interview room. Mr. Franklin, can you start off by giving us a brief biographical sketch of yourself?
Okay. Gary W. Franklin. I grew up in Hale Center, Texas. I graduated from Hale Center High School, and then I went to South Plains College for a couple of years, went to Texas Tech here for about a year, and then I got drafted in December 67 and went to Vietnam in June 68 and made it the full year and came home in June 69. My parents farmed in Hale Center, and my dad and mom both grew up around Brownwood, Texas, and then they moved to Hale Center in about 1953.
Okay. Now, growing up, in the 50s, the sentiment of the nation, I guess, at that time, were you aware of the whole Red Menace? Any thoughts about communism at that time?
In the late 50s and late 60s, when I was growing up in high school and all, and of course there was the Cuban Missile thing that came up and the crisis down there, and the sentiment was that was a main major enemy for the United States, was that the communists were trying to take over the world, and I think to a certain part there's a lot of truth to that. They were trying to domino one little country after another until communism dominated. And I think they were a lot more fanatical about that than the United States was about pushing capitalism. That kind of took care of itself if you just led by example, I guess. But that was the sentiment at the time, that the big nuclear threat from the Chinese and the Russians and that communism had to be stopped.
Now, skipping ahead a little bit, when you were drafted, thoughts, impressions?
Well, I wasn't really excited about going, but I fully expected to be drafted. Mm-hmm. At the time, I was going to Texas Tech, and a lot of people were graduating, and as soon as they graduated, they were drafted just as soon as they graduated. So I decided after about my third year in college, that I would just drop out and get it behind me. Mm-hmm. And then come back and finish my education after that.
Okay. Once you, of course, were inducted, training, etc., how do you think that, I guess describe training.
Okay. I was inducted and went to right straight to Fort Polk, Louisiana for basic training. Mm-hmm. And I got down there and got checked in, and then was sent home for a week. They closed the base for Christmas, So which I thought was kind of unusual. They could have just waited 2 or 3 days later and saved the trip back and forth.
Right.
But that's the military; they don't plan things like that. So went back after Christmas and right back into basic training. And after basic training there, that lasted 8 weeks. Then everyone got some type of assignment for advanced training, and it turned out that me and about 3/4 of the company were assigned to advanced infantry training. So we didn't really go anywhere except they put us on a bus and took us over to North Fort Polk, which they call Tigerland. And they had a big gate there at Tigerland and a sign over it that said training ground for the infantry soldier of Vietnam. Hmm. And it was very true, and everybody told us, if you're in Tigerland, your next destination is going to be Vietnam.
That was somewhat intimidating.
Yeah, but it got your attention, because training really was serious, because you didn't want to, you wanted to learn all you could, because, like they said, you were fixing to be in combat, and it was going to be in serious, and anything you missed might get you killed. So the training took a real serious turn there. Mm. It turned out that when I was there, I was one acting squad leader there in one of the platoons. So Got picked to go to Fort Knox, Kentucky for 3 weeks of advanced training in armored personnel carriers, the M113A1. So I got a little reprieve there. Got up there at Fort Knox, and during that training, they told us that probably half would get to go to Germany and half would go to Vietnam. Well, I got a little excited about that because I would have much rather served in Germany than Vietnam. And turned out when I graduated, well, I was one of the half that headed for Vietnam. So I got a 30-day leave and then was off to Vietnam. When I was there, I also had hopes if I got sent to Vietnam that I would end up in a cav unit and be in armor and be on one of the personnel carriers and I wouldn't have to walk and carry a backpack. That didn't turn out either. When I got to Vietnam, I was sent up to Mirical Division and assigned to the 198th Light Infantry Brigade and 1st and 52nd Battalion and Charlie Company to relieve or resupply a bunch of the people. They lost a lot of people just before I got there. They took a Hill 434 and lost a bunch of people. So we were reinforcing the company more or less, and it's a light infantry company. The biggest equipment we had was a 3/4-ton truck, which stayed in the rear area, and so I ended up carrying a backpack anyway. And after about 3 weeks out in the field, I was glad I didn't go in a track unit. Because we worked with H Troop and F Troop, and they just did not last. So I was better off just being a plain ground pounder.
High attrition rates?
Yeah. The track units, we had high enough. The track units were horrible, I think. I don't think they ever had anyone real experienced. And because of that reason, we even hated to work with them. Because they drew fire. And never seemed to be able to do with anything without us with them. And I think they had new people all the time. And, track units had a rough go in Vietnam. So I was glad I wasn't in armor. Or any of the track units. I think the air cav would have been real good. They had a better attrition rate than we did. But first air cav had so much firepower, they dealt it out more than took it.
Now, stepping back to training for a minute, had your instructors been to Vietnam? You know, where?
The instructors in basic training hadn't. Once we got over to Tiger Land in North Fort Polk, most of those instructors were returnees from Vietnam. And they were real knowledgeable about what was going on. Mm-hmm. And I understand that before they started using those Vietnam returnees, the attrition rate or the losses of early people over there once they got to Vietnam was a lot higher. Mm-hmm. These guys, they really knew what was going on, and they were very knowledgeable, and they'd trained us and taught us about a lot of things that had been overlooked before because it was such an unusual type of war, guerrilla war. Mm-hmm. So a lot of our instructors in AIT were, and they were very good.
So they did talk about counterinsurgency?
Oh, yeah.
Like
yeah. We did, we had a lot of training on modified squad tactics and platoon tactics, what would work because you got ambushed so much over there. Mm-hmm. And a lot of training on things like booby traps and tripwires and detecting that and watching out for it. And, mm-hmm. But that was a big thing. And they had just started a new training, which turned out to be real beneficial, and it was quick fire with BB guns.
Really?
Yeah, we went out to little targets, and they had small outline targets set up that probably wasn't 3 or 4 inches large, and they were about 6 feet away, mm-hmm. and they gave you a little automatic BB gun. Mm-hmm. And targets would pop up, and it would just quick fire. They taped a wooden stick over the sights of the BB gun, so you couldn't just aim. It was a point-and-shoot thing.
Really?
We did a lot of practice like that.
Huh.
And that turned out to be one of the most beneficial things, too. That was really good because in the ambushes of Vietnam, you most often didn't have time to aim the rifle. It was just all quick fire.
Right.
And that was a big help.
I've never heard anything like that. That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, in early 68, they were... they had modified the training tactics a lot in advanced infantry training, especially at Fort Polk.
Right.
I think some of the other forts where they had advanced infantry, like Fort Bliss down El Paso and in California and all, I think they hadn't converted to it.
Mm.
And those people had to kind of learn as they went. That part of the training was really good.
As far as weapons training, trained on the 16?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, basic training, we trained on the
M14. Right. Okay.
Once we got over to advanced infantry training, we trained on the M16 and the M60 machine gun, and did some training on the M79 grenade launcher and all the weapons we'd probably be using over there. And then we just had a day or so on the 50 caliber, but thank goodness at Fort Knox, with the armored personnel carriers, that was their main gun, was a 50 caliber machine gun. So I got a lot of additional training up there, and that helped a bit in Vietnam, because every time we could, we had 51 calibers out on the bunker line.
Hmm.
And the best unit, of course, were the quad 50s.
Right.
And
they
had some that were mounted in the back of a deuce and a half.
Oh, okay.
2.5-ton trucks. On several fire bases, on Professional and on LZ Buff, they had some mounted, basically they kind of built a bunker around them, and they buried railroad ties vertical in the hill and mounted the quad 50s on the railroad ties right at the side of the hill.
Okay.
And they made a pretty good target, but they could defend themselves very well too.
Gosh.
They were a stationary quad 50.
Hmm.
And never did get to shoot one of those. They had specialized crews, I guess. What they were was an old ball turret off of B-29s.
Okay.
And I thought they were some type of specialized deal, and they looked like it, but they just took everything off the outside of the ball turret, and they were electrically driven quad 50s, and they were pulled right out of B-29 bombers.
Wow.
And utilized them.
Huh. Okay.
They made a really effective weapon. Okay, that was I guess that's the best World War One thing they had they ever did in World War One. They're still using them today, I think.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah, 50 calibers, pretty much never could be phased out.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to replace that old thing.
Yeah.
And it had a range and a punch to do just about anything you wanted to do with it, up to a small tank or something.
Right.
That thing hit hard.
Mm. Now, in the questionnaire, you said you enjoyed the heavy weapons training. What kind of heavy weapons?
Well, we got it was mostly 51 caliber. We got a little bit of class on a 90 recoilless rifle, and a 106 recoilless rifle.
Mm.
After I got to Vietnam, we had an old sergeant that had joined up in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
He was from Guam.
Mm-hmm.
We called him the Guamanian Duke, and Sergeant Siama. And he, of course, had been in the infantry since he was 16 years old in 1944, I think. He was the oldest man I ever saw in Vietnam that was tough enough to make it in the field, because of the heat and humidity, and it just wasn't a place for older people. He was so wiry, it didn't bother him a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so he gave us some additional training on the 90mm recoilless, and really got us a good check out on that. And I guess that was about the heaviest weapon we ever got to take to the field or use, was a 90 recoilless. And with against bunkers with a heat round, which was an anti-tank round, it would really destroy a rock bunker. And against personnel with a flechette round that we called a beehive, it had 900 tiny flechettes, and it would really take care of personnel. So it was really a pretty lightweight weapon. And we didn't carry it but once or twice out in the field, but we used it a lot on the bunker line.
Yeah, I was going to ask if it was a bit cumbersome for an infantryman.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, one mission in the field, we knew we weren't going to need our mortars. We had a mortars platoon that carried an 81mm mortar, and then we all carried rounds for it. They carried the base plate and the tripod and the mortar tube, and usually two or three rounds, and we carried the rounds. Everybody carried one mortar round nearly. So we had our own mortars out in the field. And this one mission, we knew we weren't going to need mortars, so they took the 90 recoilless, and it turned out to be invaluable on that mission. But the 90 recoilless was actually a lighter weapon, and the rounds were lighter than the mortars. But we rarely took it. We usually took that 81 millimeter.
Right.
So we had our own little artillery out there. And that was mostly used, it was most effective for illumination at night. They weren't, they had about 45 minutes to get set up in the field to be really accurate. So we had to stop before they could, so they could set up. We didn't do that very often. They were pretty good in night defense, and mostly just for illumination, if we had to have illumination at night. But that was that was our kind of our heavy weapons, and that was about the heaviest we ever took.
Mm-hmm. Now, arriving in country, what was your first impression?
The heat. They flew us from Fort Lewis, Washington, to Yokota Air Force Base in Japan for fuel. We laid over there, and then on to Vietnam. And I think it was a 17-hour flight.
Mm-hmm.
And we arrived into Cameron Bay.
Oh, okay.
And Cameron Bay was like a, it was a peninsula which was almost, was probably the safest place in Vietnam. Because it was about 5 miles of minefield and sand, open sand between Cameron Bay and the mainland. Nearly impossible to get there except by boat.
Wow.
With any kind of, that you could attack.
But
it was all sandies, and I got there, we got there about 8 o'clock in the morning, and the first, my first thought was, this is killing heat. And I looked over at one of the buildings there, and you had the reflection off the white sand too, so that made it even worse. And the building was a wooden structure with a metal roof, and they had a thermometer underneath it, and it was 139 in the shade.
Wow.
And with high humidity. And I thought, this is going to be terrible. And the heat was bad for about the first, I guess for the first month or so to get acclimated to the to the heat and humidity. It was bad, especially in June and July. It was the hottest part of the year. We would lose, oh, it seemed like someone every mission would fall out due to heat exhaustion, or they would pass out, and we'd get them dusted off. And usually by the time they got back to July, with a higher altitude and the cooler air, they were okay.
Did ever happen to you?
No, I got lightheaded a couple of times and had to sit down in the shade and rest a little while, about my first month. But I never did get dusted off from heat exhaustion or heat stroke. But every once in a while, the division would lose somebody due to heat stroke every once in a while. It was just too hot for carrying a backpack, not being used to it in that 120 degree heat and the 100% humidity.
Okay.
They had started something new about 4 or 5 months before I got there, and they flew us from Cameron Bay up to Chu Lai. And Chu Lai had established a reception center, and it was right on the South China Sea, on the southeast quarter of the perimeter of Chu Lai. And everyone came into country there that's going to Americal Division spent a week there at the little reception center. They had some people that were veterans from the field, and they kind of went back over a review of your training a little bit about booby traps and the local people, and then it gave you a week to get kind of used to the heat and humidity. And they had found out it did work, because they were losing less people due to heat exhaustion and all out in the field. After they started that, they gave people a little bit of a chance to get used to it, and I think it really hit people really hard if they went over there in the summer, or probably worse in the winter, and from the northern part of the United States. You know, those guys came over there from a situation where it was 30 or 40 degree high in a day to over there when it was 110, and it just, it was too much to adjust. That was a good program too. I don't think all the country had that. I think only Americal Division had set that up.
Down to late in the war, 101st had something as well. But I
did
believe
they?
Those are the only two programs that I've heard of.
Uh-huh.
So when you arrived in country, did you know you were going to Americal right away? Or?
No, I had no idea where we were going.
Okay.
They made a decision, Cameron Bay, and they sent about 20 of us to Americal, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically who had the heaviest losses got the new people.
Right.
And that's why I ended up at Charlie Company.
Okay.
in the 198th Light Infantry Brigade because they had just taken that hill, and Alpha Company and Charlie Company had pretty heavy losses about 3 weeks before I got there. So we were kind of replacements for their losses. And I think, well, one of the guys I came in with was Bruce Fent, the one I talked about that got hurt on, well, 2 months after we got there, he got hurt on Bunker 13 there with me, and he came home. And I think of the three I think that I went out with Charlie Company, they all came in country the same time. Bruce lasted 2 months and got hurt. The other guy, I think, lasted 2 months and got killed.
Right.
And I was the only one that lasted a full year and came home. But there were, I think there were about 30 of us that headed up the AmeriCal Division that were with me. And it turned out to be, I guess, a good place to be if you're going to have to be in the infantry. In the infantry in the field, it was a pretty good place to be.
Let's see. So when you arrived, you were just a rifleman?
Yeah.
How soon after were you chosen to be in the RTO?
Oh. I became Tim's RTO, the guy I told you about I found in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
He decided I'd carry the radio after I got hurt on Buff, so I'd been there about 2 months.
Okay.
And I was a rifleman and point man before that.
Really?
Of course, riflemen were usually point men. I was a rifleman there for about 2 months. And then after I got hit in the shoulder and the hip, well, I spent about a week and a half at 91st Evac, and they sent me back out to the field. And Tim decided then that I'd probably do better while I recuperated as an RTO.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out later that part of that too was he and Ardway thought that was the best way they could train me to be a squad leader, to know what was really going on all the time. So I carried a radio for Tim there for about 2 months, I guess.
Okay.
And they were kind of plotting against me, I think.
Yeah, I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. What was it like walking plant?
Well, at first it's really scary. But after a while, you got used to everything, and somebody said one time that the loneliest thing in the world was a point man in Vietnam, because everyone tried to stay about 10 to 15 meters apart, you know, just for sniper reasons and booby traps. But the point man, they wanted you out there 50, 75 meters, and it's kind of a lonely feeling out there, but. After being there for a while, I realized that the point man usually wasn't the one hitting ambush.
Mm.
It was the center of the element, and they, you know, they were pretty smart. And they let the point man go by, and then when they bust the ambush, they busted on the guys behind you,
because
that way they thought, especially if they could hit the guy next to the radio, then they'd try to get the squad leader in the RTO, and then everybody was in a mess, you know. So it was dangerous from a point that if you walked straight into an ambush. And they had no choice. They wouldn't let you go through. But if you were walking by, they often let you by.
Hmm.
You know, that happened to me once too. But it was. I think the modification I would have about being lonely was it was the loneliest thing in the world being point man in Vietnam at night.
Hmm.
Daytime wasn't near as spooky at night.
Really?
Because night you'd often lose visibility of the other guys. And we tried not to do that, but that sometime would start to really worry you.
Wow.
If you couldn't see the guys behind you, or you'd lose sight of somebody for a while. I got really good at scanning and of course detecting trip wires and stuff like that. And you really had to look after that.
Mm-hmm. Did you encounter a lot of booby traps?
Yeah, we found a lot of them. Or ran across a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we lost probably most of our casualties.
Right.
Mines and booby traps.
Mm-hmm.
They were real sneaky about it, I guess you'd say.
Mm-hmm.
They were real slick as ways to set up mines and booby traps. And when I got over there, They had taught us about punji pits, and they had these ankle crushers, a little box that would turn in on your ankles. And we found one of those, but the wood was starting to get kind of rotten. And what they would do, they just built a wooden box, and most of it out of teak wood. But they would put two planks in it, and the planks would have nails driven from the back side, and usually it was a double wood so that the nails couldn't push back out. You know, they'd drive the nails in one piece of wood, nail another piece of wood behind it to hold the nails, and then they would put it on big nail hinges. And you'd step in the center, and your own weight would turn it in. And your own weight would also drive the nails right through your ankle, and they call them ankle crushers.
Wow.
And we found one or two of those, but they had gotten pretty rotten, and we found a few of the punji pits that you would step in. But by the time I got there in mid-68, they had discovered explosives. And they didn't mess too much with the bamboo punji pits and that sort of stuff.
Really?
Because they were... Well, the Russians were giving them a lot of bouncing Bettys, I guess, and anti-tank mines. They had a lot of that to play with. And we were giving them a lot of dud artillery and bombs. So I think they had a almost unlimited cache of explosives to mess with, and they didn't build too many punji pits and stuff anymore. And just didn't mess with it. And one thing we ran into a lot, there south of Chulai, we were working the areas around the Pinkville area, where Cali got in trouble. We worked that area a lot when I first got there. And there were a lot of villagers, a lot of Viet Cong, and a lot of that area, the French had mined it. And there were little French minefields everywhere. And the French didn't record anything. They didn't have any records. So we found them the hard way. We found a lot of them at night. And we'd be in the middle of a French minefield, and somebody would get a foot blown off, and we wouldn't know how to get out. So we wouldn't know which way was out, and usually just blind luck. And we slowly were getting all those minefields recorded just from people having feet and legs blown off. But a lot of that, it wasn't the Viet Cong, it was the French. They didn't, I guess they thought they would defend an area, and they just mined it, and they didn't even make records of it. And They were getting real are fairly sophisticated with their mines and stuff too, and the booby traps. We had several people of them, or several times other squads. We didn't ever have it happen, but they would have a small minor booby trap that'd blow half of somebody's foot off or something, and then there would be a delayed fuse for a minute later, and they might have a 105 howitzer round or even 250 or 500 pound bomb buried.
Jeez.
And so, you know, they knew as soon as somebody got half a foot blown off, all their buddies was going to rush up there to help them. And about a minute later, the big one would go off and take everybody. So that happened a few times to other sister platoons and stuff.
Wow.
That was something we always worried about. In fact, we got to where somebody would step on a booby trap, so we'd wait a minute or so. Figured they probably wouldn't bleed to death anyway within a minute or two, so we'd wait.
Survivability.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Well, you didn't help them any getting blown away with them.
Yeah.
And luckily it never happened to our squad or our platoon, but it happened quite a bit. Just before I left, they lost about five people at Chulai because they had bought these cigarette lighters at the PX. And they were Zippos, and they were sold to people out there at the PX. Well, there was a little village named Anton, and some of it came from Benson too. They would engrave them with your unit emblem, Maricale, or you could buy one of the 198th emblem, but they would engrave these real pretty Zippo lighters. And I think they were about $5 a lighter.
Wow.
About $3.50 just the plain lighter, and about $5 for the engraved one. Well, they had three people got killed there in July, and it turned out that they were having the charges going off in their pocket, either in their shirt pocket or their pants pocket. And it either killed them by stopping their heart or blew the femoral artery out in their pants pocket.
Wow.
And they figured out what was going on. when one of the Air Force pilots bought one of those lighters, and the first thing he did was lit a cigarette with it and set it on a shelf back at his hooch. First time he ever used it. And turned around, he's smoking a cigarette, and the thing blew up on their shelf, and he just got a little shrapnel in the head, and that's when they figured out it was the cigarette lighters.
Wow.
They went back over to PX and pulled them all off the shelf, and about three quarters of them had a cotton in there that where you put the rosin off with it.
Mm-hmm.
The cotton had some C4 in it. They'd pulled about half the cotton out and packed it with C4 and had a little detonator underneath the fuse.
Hmm.
So when you struck it, it lit the fuse, and about 5 seconds later, it burned down to a little detonator and detonated that C4.
Wow.
And, of course, they went hunting the guy that engraved the lighters, and he was long gone.
Mm.
But they were real sneaky. I think one of the nastiest tricks, almost totally impossible to detect, there at Chu Lai, there were, I think, 6,000 Vietnamese that worked there.
Mm-hmm.
Big base. And they cleaned hooches for the officers and filled sandbags and did whatever they could, you know, be hired to do. And, you know, the military trucks had a big, about 3.5-inch gas cap.
Mm-hmm.
And they would pick up one of our grenades, because at the mess halls or whatever, there was always ammunition belts or stuff laying around with grenades attached to them.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the South Vietnamese would pick up a grenade and put a rubber band around the spoon, pull the pin and drop it in the gas tank, put the cap back on.
Mm-hmm.
It'd take about a day and a half for the gasoline to eat the rubber band up. And then they had not only the grenade, but, you know, the Jeeps with gas tanks right underneath the seat. And they would usually have half a tank or a full tank of gasoline. That thing would go up, it'd blow the Jeep nearly in half.
Wow.
Now that was something that the guys back at July had to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how you could have kept them out of it. Let's put locking gas caps on there. Then they'd have thought of something else.
So were you primarily operating at Chu Lai or at a forward base?
I guess we never really worked out of Chu Lai. When I first got there, there's a brigade fire base about 3 or 4 miles south of Chu Lai called Gator.
Okay.
And we worked out of Gator there.
Hmm.
And it was kind of a large fire base, and we had really a tent for the whole squad.
Mm-hmm.
And we just operated day patrols and ambushes out of there. And that lasted about a week. And then we moved from there to a fire base, LZ Dottie and LZ Buff.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked out of there. We were either on bunker duty, and they had artillery and mortars.
Mm-hmm.
And Dottie was another big artillery base, too. It was a very low hill, but they could drive trucks down off Highway 1, and they'd turn right off Highway 1 up Dottie and resupply right up to the 2.5-ton trucks.
Excellent.
Deuce and a quarter. So they didn't have to fly everything into Dottie.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the whole rest of the year we worked off just the artillery fire bases.
Mm-hmm.
Off the LZs.
Okay.
And spent a little time on nearly every one of them around there, I guess.
Okay.
And we stayed there south of Chu Lai, which was primarily a lot of villages and a lot of Viet Cong, till 17th of September. So we were there about 3 months after I got there.
Mm-hmm.
Then we went back, what we call north. We went up there in an operation called Burlington Trail, and we were to reopen the road between Tam Kỳ and Tiên Phước Special Forces Base. And it was an old French Special Forces base about 6 or 8 miles west of Tam Kỳ.
Mm-hmm.
And manned by, I think they had 10 or 15 Green Berets, and they were training in advisors to what they call CIDG, the Mountain Guard unit. And they were some good fighters. They were the only really good fighters I ever saw in South Vietnamese. The standard Arvins weren't worth a dime.
Right.
But those Mountain Guards were a pretty tough unit.
Hmm.
But they had good habits, because they had American advisors, and they didn't have, I don't think they had anybody over a South Vietnamese lieutenant. They didn't have any real officers except those advisors. They were Green Berets. And they were pretty good. Up there, there weren't many villagers. It was nearly all what we call a free fire zone.
Mm-hmm.
They had been told a year before to get out.
Right.
And the ones that stayed just stayed at their own risk.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few Hoochies and villagers around there. But mostly up there just fighting the NVA.
Mm-hmm.
They were determined not to let us reopen the road, and we were determined to reopen it. And we stayed there till ninth of March '69. We stayed there nearly 7 months. Well, I guess, yeah, about 7 months. And we got in a big fight there in a brigade base camp, and the whole battalion pretty well got chewed up. And so to rebuild again, they pulled us out and moved us back south of July, which is back where I started at, back mm-hmm. around Buff and Dottie. And I spent my last last 3 months down there. Spent my first 3 months there and my last 3 months there, and the other 6 months was up what we call up north.
Mm-hmm.
North of July. But we spent pretty much the whole year out in the field working off fire bases.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't understand why at first. It made more and more sense as we went along, but the two best companies in the battalion were Alpha Company and Charlie Company. Bravo Company was kind of okay, and Delta Company never seemed to get their act together.
Mm-hmm.
So Delta Company spent about 3/4 of their time on the fire bases, and Alpha Company and Charlie Company, and usually Bravo, we spent about 3/4 of our time out in the field.
Mm-hmm.
So we would be out in the field about 3 weeks and back on the fire base maybe 3 or 4 days, and back out in the field 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah, so that's good. And how long standard operation would last?
And yeah.
How much food would you take out in the
uh-huh.
field?
We usually pack sea rations and food for about 4 days,
okay.
which would be 12 meals.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, because... Well, we did that because we usually got resupplied with food and ammunition every third or fourth day. They'd bring out one of the Minutemen helicopters would bring out mail and sea rations and ammunition, whatever we needed.
Okay.
And two, they'd take personnel back and forth. Sometimes we'd have somebody going R&R or something, mm-hmm. you know. Or we'd get new guys come in the field and they'd bring them out. The normal missions for us out in the field lasted 2 to 3 weeks normally.
Mm-hmm.
It was real normal for Charlie Company to spend 3 weeks out in the field and 2 or 3 days on the fire base and another 3 weeks out in the field.
Wow. Now, when you're going into an AO, were you pretty much just foot slogging it out there, or were you hell of more?
Most of the time, we just walked off.
Okay.
It all depended on the mission and where they needed somebody. Sometimes they would airlift us from one part, and we'd be out in the field, and they'd say, you know, find a good LZ. We got 6 or 8 helicopters on the way, and we're going to move you.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go from one LZ to, from one, you know, what we would call them LZ. They were just little landing zones,
mm-hmm.
wherever they picked us up,
right.
A pickup zone or whatever. They'd pick us up and take us somewhere else. But sometimes we'd leave, if they had a mission come up real quick and they needed us somewhere fast for a blocking or to go relieve somebody, try to help another company, then they would pick us up with helicopters and take us out.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, we just walked back to the fire base and walked off the fire base.
Mm-hmm.
And it kept the helicopters, I guess, freed up so they could resupply and dust off.
Mm-hmm.
We did a lot of airlifts. Sometimes, several times during the year, they picked us up with a C-47 Chinooks.
Oh, really?
And took us out on them. We didn't really like flying those Chinooks.
Mm-hmm.
They were, they relied too much on the hydraulic systems.
Mm.
If they lost hydraulic pressure, the party was over.
Mm.
And they flew primarily the Chinooks lifted artillery pieces and ammunition and a little single action water trailers,
mm-hmm.
which we call water buffaloes,
right. That's
the nickname. They brought them out to the hill. The Chinooks usually stayed busy just moving things back and forth,
mm-hmm.
and picking up down slicks. But every once in a while, they would want to move. They could get us in two good lifts, and they would just move us with a Chinook instead of the Hueys. And a lot of that depended on how secure the LZ was. If they were absolutely sure, like sometimes they moved us from firebase to firebase, and we might go in a Chinook. Mm-hmm. But out in the field, normally they dropped us off in the Slicks, because the Chinooks, when they got slow and low, they were real targets.
Yeah.
They didn't take punishment very good.
Big target too.
Yeah, they were big. They had a couple of door gunners, but they didn't. They weren't very used to defending themselves like the Slicks were, and they weren't agile. They just made a big. They made a terrible target. And I think some of the door gunners and pilots I talked to, they didn't really like flying the Chinooks.
Huh.
But, you know, that was their job.
I've heard some mixed reviews of them, but yeah, it seems to be the tendency. They were just too slow and too big.
Yeah, too big a target.
Right.
If you could damage one rotor bad, the whole thing is going down because they overlapped.
Right.
And they were geared together.
Huh.
With a good load and the heat and humidity of Vietnam, they couldn't maintain level flight with one engine down. They had two engines for supposedly for safety, and they needed the power, but one engine got hit, what they were going to do was a nice glide. They could do a powered glide on one engine. They really couldn't maintain altitude. And we had one, I know they, luckily it was only the air crew in there, but I think it was in February, they took some hits with a 51 caliber, headed back to Chu Lai, and they were right beside their maintenance building and were just setting down. They were hovering and just setting down. They run out of hydraulics.
Oof.
And lost control of the thing, and it rolled on its side about 20 foot off the ground and went right straight into the side of their maintenance building and killed the whole crew.
Oh,
and they were right there. But, you know, it had been a Slick. They could have just made a little 20 foot auto rotation and sat down and got out. But
yeah.
The Chinooks were, they were just more of a target, more of a handful to fly, I think. They were good workhorse, and I guess they still are.
Mm, yeah. I was a unit back, based close to where I am, where I'm from, back in New York.
Uh-huh.
So we get them coming over all the time.
Yeah.
It's a neat helicopter.
Yeah. One thing we didn't like about them, it's already hot in Vietnam.
Mm.
And when you load off the up the back ramp, That rear rotor is blowing both jet engines right on you, and God, it must be 250 degrees climbing into one of those things. It'd burn you alive. Yeah. Yeah, fortunately, the trips we had in them were all pleasant trips.
That's good. So, I guess getting back to being out in the bush. I guess, what was the, could you describe the incident where you were wounded?
Oh, on Buff?
Yeah.
The first time?
Yeah.
Well, it was the main time.
Yeah.
We had been warned, and we were on 100% alert, that there was a buildup of NVA and Viet Cong in the whole area, and they had captured some people, and they knew sometime during the week that they were going to try to hit Binh Son.
Mm-hmm.
Binh Son was a fairly good village, fairly sized village on Highway 1.
Mm-hmm.
And the Arvins had kind of a regional headquarters there. And then we had LZ Dottie was there close,
mm-hmm.
big fire base. And Buff was a fairly good sized fire base. We had 105 howitzers, our own 81 millimeter mortars, and four deuce mortars.
Mm-hmm.
And It wasn't too big a fire base at the time. We had a 3rd platoon and 2nd platoon were there. The captain and 1st platoon were over on Dottie.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had 100% alert. It happened to be I was on a bunker next to the corner bunker. I was on bunker 13. And we had a flood lamp unit that they had flown out.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing was an Army Jeep with a big generator in the back and a flood lamp that looked kind of like a large, it looked like a huge television camera kind of,
mm-hmm.
or not a camera, but a television. And it was a flood lamp could generate a million candlelight power.
Mm-hmm.
And supposedly, this guy told us when they backed up there beside our bunker, they got a little behind our bunker and beside it, and he said, they won't shoot at this because it'll blind them. This thing puts out so much light. You see the same thing on the front of tanks,
uh-huh.
on the M60 tanks
yeah.
at them. But the tanks could go for 2.5 million for, I think, a minute.
Hmm.
and it would discharge your batteries. It would eventually kill the tank.
Mm.
So they couldn't do it very long. But the little generator they said they could go a million cannon power, and he said they won't shoot at this because it'll blind them and they can't even see to shoot at it. Well, about 2:30 that morning, they suddenly hit LZ Dottie over there, and Dottie was maybe 3 miles away.
Mm.
It was right on Highway 1. And boy, it was taking a pounding. They were taking incoming rockets and RPGs, and we had the radio. We was listening to them, and we should have been paying more attention to our own perimeter. But we figured we might get hit, but we thought we was ready, and we were watching Dottie. And about 2:30, they hit us with mortars,
mm-hmm.
and started mortaring Buff real heavy. And the guy hopped in the Jeep, cranked up the generator. He turned that spotlight on, and it was on about 3 seconds. and somebody had good enough vision to hit it, because they hit it with an RPG, and
Oh, geez.
Just blew the whole back out of the Jeep. I think some of the shrapnel I got back in my shoulder, I think, came off that Jeep. But they just blew the back end out of that thing. It was a good thing we had with me and Bruce Fent with the two Charlie Company grunts there. And then we had the two guys that run the flood lamp. So we had four people in our bunker.
Mm-hmm.
And we had five. We had a black kid named Spence. And they blew that thing. And we were just taking heavy mortars. And from the next morning, I could tell at some time they hit the front of our bunker with an RPG, one of the B-40 rockets.
Because
mm-hmm. they blew about one layer of sandbag off the front of the bunker. And we were, we were on the radio, and everybody was yelling for illumination because we couldn't see a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they blew the bunk, the corner bunker beside us, which Calentine was in.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out later it killed both of them instantly because they were they made a mistake of being inside the bunker,
mm-hmm.
which is a almost suicidal mistake. Especially if you get mortared, the first thing you want to do is get on top of the bunker because normally by the time the mortars hit, they were already inside the wire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they would crawl through the wire or something. And Ardway said what they'd done that night, they found the next morning, they took a bunch of metal stakes and they laid them on the wire and pushed the wire down.
Mm.
And somebody had crawled in there and checked it for trip flares already.
Mm.
But they tried that, and they were already inside the wire. And as soon as the mortar ends hit, they were past the bunkers on our side.
Wow.
They got inside there and were throwing grenades up in the mortar pit, mm. which kept the mortars from guys from getting out and getting a single illumination. And then they blew the bunker number 14 there. They threw about a 40-pound satchel charge in it and detonated it. Calentine and the other guy were both inside the bunker.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Ardway said he was in a hammock asleep and killed both of them. Our platoon medic, which I found out was Doc Schwamm. I didn't know him very well, but I'd only been in country about 2 months when all this happened. And been out with Charlie Company about a month and a half. He grabbed his medical stuff, and he was in bunker 15. He was in the other one near the corner. And he grabbed his medical bag. He should have took his M16 with him, but he went running towards 14 because he thought he could get over there and help the guys, Calentine and his buddy. Well, just when he got there, he realized that there was someone standing in the middle of the bunker in all the rubble. And the bunker was blown completely in except for about half the front wall. And it turned out that it wasn't one of our guys standing in the middle of the bunker. It was the NVA. And had an AK-47. And he shot Doc in the stomach and hit both femoral arteries.
Oh,
and he made it back to bunker 14, bunker 15. And I think Hardway was there with him. And they got down in the bunker, got flashlights out, got his medical kit. But when he saw where he was hit, he said, "Guys, I'll make it about a minute and a half. I'm going to bleed to death." And he did. There was a pool of blood. There was about 5 gallons of blood over there in the bottom of that bunker. I can't imagine a human having that much blood. But he bled to death in about a minute and a half. You know, he just said, "Somebody hold my hand." And about a minute and a half, he was gone. So I found out by the battalion daily staff report that they trained 106 recalled his rifle on Bunker 14 in case it really, the over, and well, in case more people got up through the perimeter mm-hmm. and they really overrun that corner, they were just going to bust the place with a 106 recallless and a fachette round. Mm-hmm. And we fought for, I guess, about 20 minutes. And the ones we didn't kill coming in, we killed them going back out.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, those guys had been up the mortar pit. I think there was two Viet Cong or North Vietnamese. It's hard to tell because they came through the wire strip down to just underwire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they could feel everything. So they didn't have any uniforms on and really couldn't tell if they were NVA or Viet Cong. But they were from the 403rd Sapper Battalion. Mm-hmm. I got one of their little handmade cigarette lighters,
mm-hmm.
which is probably beat out of one of our airplanes, I imagine. It's a little handmade aluminum lighter. Mm-hmm. And they just had grenades up there, and they threw all the grenades, and they tried to run back out, and we killed them going out.
Mm-hmm.
We dusted off about 3:30 that morning after things died down. We got some illumination about the time all the fighting was over. Our mortar guys never could get out there and get the gun going, and they finally got us illumination from Dottie,
mm-hmm.
one of the 105 howitzers fired over to Buff and got us illumination that way. And we got the situation quieting back down, and we dusted off Spence and the one of the guys that run the floodlight there with me. Took a mortar round right between the legs. I think we had two mortar rounds actually hit our bunker.
Mm-hmm.
But one of them was when Fent got blue unconscious. We built us a little fighting position in the front right corner of the bunker, and we sandbagged it. We double sandbagged it. It was big enough one person could get in there,
mm-hmm.
and we had all of our grenades and strung around on top of it, and we nice little fighting position. Well, it saved our hide, but not because we got in there and fight. One of the first mortar rounds, I think, hit inside that fighting position, and,
mm.
and it blew the sandbags off and blew all of our grenades away,
mm.
and hurt Fent pretty bad, but it probably saved the other two of us. And then one of the guys had a 60 millimeter mortar. It was either a mortar or a good sized grenade went off right between his legs, and it turned out he bled to death on the way. He was, I think he was conscious when we got him on the dust off, but that was about 30 minutes after he got hit.
Mm.
And he was dead on arrival, and he got back to July at the hospital. We got them out of there about 3:30. And then the other guy from the flood lamp and I stayed there till about 6:30 the next morning after sunup, because we were low people, and we weren't hurt that bad.
Mm.
We weren't bleeding enough to where it was a serious problem or anything. So we just stayed there and defended the bunker,
mm.
and was nearly out of personnel.
Mm.
I think they had two or three other wounded really bad too in some of the other bunkers there on Buff. So it was the first time that we got overrun or something, and first time things got really serious for me. And I was kind of unusual. I went into I think it's a 312 surgical. I think that's what it was. But there in July they had a regular hospital,
mm-hmm.
you know. But it's mainly just surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't keep people there very long. If you were hurt real bad, they sent you to Japan or the United States.
Mm-hmm.
If you were hurt a little bit like we were, they sewed you up, cleaned your wounds, sent you over to 91st and back, and you stayed about a week and a half there.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of a recuperation. And I got in there, and when I got in there, I was thinking, yeah, I was hurt pretty bad, you know. And I got in there, and we had 14 guys there in triage being prepped.
Mm-hmm.
And what they were doing with most of them, they put us on hold. They checked us over real quick and said, you know, sit down in that bed, and we'll call you when we get to you. And most of them, they were trying to get them strong enough for surgery.
Mm.
And out of the 14 there, I think 9 were unconscious.
Mm.
And they lost about 5 before they could even get them in surgery.
Wow.
And sometime there, I got to thinking, well, maybe I ain't hurt at all. You know,
wow.
This is not bad. Those guys were hurt. They were really tore up pretty bad from... well, they hit nearly every one of the major fire bases in Mirkell Division that night.
Mm-hmm.
So they had wounded from all over. And they, I found out then that the surgery and everything is not like MASH on TV.
Mm.
They don't pick out every little piece of shrapnel and everything. Mm. They find what's hurt, what really might do some future damage, what's hurt real bad, and cut artery, cut vein, piece of shrapnel near your heart, piece of shrapnel near your spinal column, anything else they leave in place.
Really?
It's already hot and cauterized. And if they don't think it's going to hurt you much, they just leave it. And they really didn't have time to mess with it, really. They had people hurt 10 times worse than you were. So they were rushing people through there just as fast as they could. And I wouldn't say the medical care wasn't good. Those guys were mostly young, grafted doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time they came home, they were probably super surgeons.
Mm-hmm.
They were really good, and I think they were really conscientious about what they did. They just had their hands full so much that they didn't have time to take the time to do anything special.
Yeah.
They patched you up and away you went.
Hmm. So how was the time staying at 91st EVAC?
Got chewed out a lot.
over
there they were soon senior medics.
Huh.
And those guys were pretty experienced. And what we found out, I didn't know it till I got there. I knew the officers only had to spend 6 months in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And you just plain old grunt spend a year. But they had such a hard time keeping officers alive, or they were losing so many officers, it was such a tough job that they only had to spend 6 months in the field. And it's the same way with medics.
Mm-hmm.
They spent 6 months out in the field, and then if they lived that long, they got to rotate back to something, a job back in July, either working in surgery or working over there at 91st EVAC or something like that. Those guys were pretty experienced. And I knew they were busy. They were always had somebody they needed to take care of, So I kept getting up and going, getting a book or something. And they deburred my wounds, which is just, they just cut the skin on the outside and cleaned it up, because shrapnel makes a real jagged, torn wound.
Mm.
So they deburred my wounds. Then they wait about 3 or 4 days to see if you get infection. And Vietnam was notorious for infection.
Mm.
So if you didn't get infection, then they sewed you up. If you did get infection, then they sent you to Japan. And I didn't get any infection, so they sewed me up over there at 91st EVAC. And during that first 3 or 4 days, I kept getting up and going and getting me a book or something to do, because I get so bored. And mainly I just real stiff and sore.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd break my wound open and start bleeding again.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'd get the bed messed up and then I'd get chewed out. So after about the second day, I gave up and I just called, when I want something.
Because
I realized that I wasn't saving them any trouble.
Right.
They were spending more trouble changing my bandages and cleaning the bed up than anything else. So I just called them, could you go get me a book? Or
wow.
Yeah, I got chewed out a bunch over there. And that was that was pretty entertaining too. It was out, at least I got out of the field and got hot food for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Once over there, and I never did get wounded that bad again. Didn't really want to.
Mm-hmm.
But once in there is enough.
Well, we've been going for about an hour. Would you like to take a break?
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay. Just pause this. Switch the talk.
Yeah. I asked the guy if he liked flying the Skyraider. Because to me, that was an old fighter plane, Big old radial engine and big old 14-foot propeller. Mm.
They're man, beautiful airplane.
Real airplane.
Yeah.
And he said when they first assigned them to Vietnam for ground support, the Air Force thought they would have to order the young lieutenants into them.
Mm-hmm.
Because they thought everybody wanted to fly the Phantoms,
mm-hmm.
the jets. And he said it didn't turn out to be the truth. He said he had never seen a person in a Skyraider below the rank of bird colonel.
Really?
But they pulled the rank and they got in the Skyraiders. And he said he loved them.
Wow.
And he felt safe in it. And he told me that he had taken a B-40 rocket one time right straight into the engine cowling, and he thought he was in serious trouble. But he had always not worried because he had his armor plate, unless a sniper could actually hit him.
Right.
And even the control surfaces, I think they had tarp tubes, backed up by cables with hydraulic assist.
Right.
And any one of the three systems could easily fly the airplane. It got a little stiff with the cables, but if you kept the speed below 200 or 300 mile an hour, it's still easily flyable. But he said he saw the smoke coming, this B-40 rocket went right straight into his engine, knocked three cylinders completely off of it. And he was streaming oil, and I think he only had, I think he said he had 160 gallons of oil. But he said he was streaming oil, blew three cylinders off, and he said, man, I must have been down to 2,000 horsepower. And he shoved the fire in it, and went back to July, and he was back in the air the next day.
Wow.
Put him a new cowling, three cylinders, he was back in the air. He loved this Sky Raider. We love to watch
airplane.
They're the fantastic airplane.
So, I guess, you know, we can talk about air support a bit. Was primarily Phantoms working with?
It was primarily. I probably 50% of the A4 Skyhawks in Phantoms.
Okay.
We've got some Skyhawks even off carriers, I understand.
Hmm.
But the Navy had a wing of Skyhawks are at July.
Mm-hmm.
And then then there were always Marine Phantoms coming and going. The Air Force had a big wing of Phantoms off out of July there.
Right.
And I think they flew missions both for us and up north.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to see a lot of air shows with Phantoms.
Mm-hmm.
And the Skyhawks and even the old Sky Raiders.
Mm-hmm. What about helicopter gunship support?
We had both. Out of July there was the, I think the Sharks and the Minutemen.
Right.
And the Muskets. I nearly forgot about them. But we love the Sharks just because they have a big mouth on them. And we thought all gunships ought to have a big tiger mouth.
I'm actually working on a model of one of their ships right now.
Yeah, one of the Blue Ghosts, I think. And they work all around July.
Right.
We had some Cobra gunships.
Uh-huh.
Most of them were the old UH-1 Alpha,
mm-hmm.
the old Huey gunships. Uh-huh. And I talked to some of the helicopter pilots, and they were kind of, they liked both ships. They liked the Cobra because it was hardened,
mm-hmm.
but they liked the Huey because their own gunners out the side could cover their six when they left the target.
Mm-hmm.
They could shoot behind them.
Right. Self.
Which some of the Cobras couldn't do. They just had to rely on armor plate. But we had quite a bit of both. We had one, and I found a little excerpt there in the Battalion Daily Staff Journals from March the 3rd to the 6th. I think it was on March 5th. We had one of the gunships come over, and one of the Minutemen, I think, was supporting us out there north of Ten Fuck, and it was north of Professional, and east of Ten Fuck, and they took some 51 caliber hits in the rocket pot, and it set off one of the rockets.
Oof.
And the staff report said it burned one of the loader and side gunner's face a little bit, and two of them caught shrapnel, but it wasn't very bad shrapnel. And what I remembered was one of the gunners crawled out there on the pod and was kicking the pod, trying to kick the pod off the gunship because it was smoking like crazy. It was on fire, and they still had six or seven rockets.
Oh.
And it turned out to be quite a show because he was surfing around and around up there. And the first thing they did when they got hit, it was kind of an explosion and a bunch of smoke come off that rocket pod on the right side of the old gunship. And then, of course, he fired everything he had. To not in any certain place. He just hit the button and tried to fire all the rockets. Mm-hmm. About six of them left at one time and went God knows where.
Wow.
They just exited the scene. And he still had two or three rockets in there, I think, and then that gunner climbed out there and he kicked the pad for about 5 minutes. He finally kicked the thing off.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. It was just dangling already.
Huh.
And he kicked and beat around on it until it finally left before it blew up. It went down into the jungle.
Huh.
The helicopter gunships were real effective.
Mm.
They were slightly vulnerable, I guess, to 51 caliber fire, but and small arms fire. But very few gunships I saw got shot down.
Mm.
Saw a lot of they just plain old resupply, and they got shot down a lot.
Yeah.
Usually just auto rotate in and got somebody hurt and shot up or something. They'd go extract them with a Chinook.
Mm.
They'd all be back in the air in a day or two.
Mm.
The gunship support was real good.
So, I guess operating as the RTO, you'd be coordinating everyone?
Yeah, I did a lot of talking to him with his RTO. Mm-hmm. That only lasted a couple of months, and then Tim was getting real sharp and going home for the last around 7.5-8 months I was a squad leader.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent a lot of time on the radio with him, mm-hmm. calling in artillery or gunships or whatever, you know. I didn't know till I read some reports that they've received this last 6 or 8 months from Dan Young in the 1st and 52nd, but our artillery there in the Maricao Division was rated as one of the best in Vietnam.
Hmm.
And they were good, but I didn't know how everybody else was. All I knew was our artillery was normally very good,
mm-hmm.
real accurate. They could really put it around where you wanted it. And I think part of that was pressure on them, because about my 4th month there, we figured out that the standard procedure was to call first round 100 meter Heidel burst of smoke, with white phosphorus, and they would they'd have a 100 meter aerial burst, and by that we could tell where the HE was going to hit.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea was safety. You call first round 100 meter Heidel burst. And then you made sure that you were on target.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the NVA, they knew as much about where the artillery was going to hit as we did. They would see the first round white phosphorus at 100 meter Heidel burst. They knew where the next HE round was going to hit, and they'd be gone before it hit. So we gave up on that after I was there about 4th month. I guess it was about October 68.
Mm-hmm.
We started calling first round HE on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And we just call HE on the ground the first round and make sure that we knew where we were,
mm-hmm.
where we were calling artillery, and made sure that artillery understood that they better hit where we called it. Somebody was going to get hurt.
Yeah.
And I think that was part of the reason they were real good, because they had to be. Our artillery support was real good. I only heard of one instance, I think it was before I got there, they put somebody screwed up and they got an air up round into Charlie Company and wounded 4 or 5 guys, I think. If they had 105 howitzer round come right into the perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it was artillery mistake, it could have been whoever called it in.
Mm-hmm.
That sometimes happened too. Mm-hmm. Called the wrong coordinates in.
So.
Another sideline of the artillery, we were getting the first ones we were calling those aerial bursts, a lot of them were going off halfway out or even after they hit the ground.
Mm-hmm.
They were duds, and mm-hmm. they discovered the reason was they came out with a new artillery round, which was setting itself by barometric pressure. They were supposed to adjust the barometric pressure to current barometric pressure,
mm-hmm.
and then by that it would trigger the round to go off at the right altitude.
Mm-hmm.
And Vietnam, the heat and humidity, I think, was just eating the barometric sensors up.
Right.
And they were going off. They'd go through a cloud and go off. They'd go off 1,000 foot in the air. They were totally undependable.
Wow.
So they went back to the old rounds they had in World War II.
Which proximity,
they set the timer.
Mm-hmm.
They set a time and calculated the distance, and they went off 100 meter off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So they went back to that. It was accurate. It worked.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of those brilliant ideas that just didn't work. Got over there and tried to use them. We had a pretty good affection with the artillery guys, the cannon coppers.
Mm-hmm.
They could really save your hide in a pinch. And fortunately, all the ones there in our Mercal division, as far as I worked with, were really good artillery people.
Mm-hmm.
They were quick and knew what they were doing.
So, when you found out you were sort of, I guess, set up to be a squad leader, how'd you feel about that?
I didn't feel like I was ready.
Right.
And what happened, Tim was going home, and our buddy was one of our fire team leaders, and I was carrying the radio for Tim. I was the RTO. And they had a little powwow, and I knew from what they'd been talking about for the last 3 weeks, they were going to decide who was going to be the squad leader. I naturally figured it was going to be Ardway.
Mm-hmm.
Because he only had about 4 months left in country. And they got through the little powwow, and I said, okay, who's it going to be? And he said, well, it's going to be you. And I said, I don't think I'm ready for that. And Ardway said, I'll train you. Don't worry about it. And what they decided was that since he just had 4 months left, he was going to be a short timer pretty quick, too. And I still had nearly 8 months left. And so Ardway was going to train me since he was the experienced guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he did. He advised me on anything I needed to know. He made sure I didn't screw up. So I became a squad leader pretty early in my career, or my time in Vietnam. So I was a squad leader for about the last 7 months. And it worked out. And it didn't help Hardway that much anyway, because about the second month, we got a new lieutenant. We got a couple of guys hurt, and all of a sudden they had to have a squad leader, and I think the second squad, and he was it.
Right.
So that didn't work very long. You did whatever worked at the time for everybody. You know, whatever was important for the platoon was important. That's what you had to do. So his idea of just shamming into becoming a short timer and going home and never being a squad leader didn't work out. It worked for about a month and a half or 2 months, and then he spent his last couple of months as a squad leader too.
Right.
Same platoon, but it had to be done. That worked out. He was a real good experienced guy, and taught me a lot of things. And somehow, Tim came home. Tim was wounded, I think, 4 times. I was wounded 3 times. Everybody I knew was wounded 3 or 4 times, nearly. But Ardway came home. He was there the whole year, from January 68 to December 68, and was never wounded.
Hmm.
Which is a miraculous.
Wow.
How he did that.
That's,
he was lucky.
Yeah.
Sure. Blind luck.
Very. Now, kind of completely got away from all my questions.
Yeah, get away. Well, let's get off on his other stuff.
This has been great. In the questionnaire, it asked if you had, if there were any weapons or equipment that you didn't have that you wanted. Anything?
Not other than the 90 recallists, which we couldn't carry in the field anyway.
Mm-hmm.
There was a weapon that they took away from the infantry units before I got there.
Mm-hmm.
They had come up with an M79 canister round,
mm-hmm.
so the M79 guys could walk point if they needed to.
Right.
And basically, what it was, it turned the M79 into a 40mm shotgun,
mm-hmm.
and they did it with a plastic. There's a plastic cartridge on the front of the round,
mm-hmm.
instead of the HE. And it was it had a little small solid center part that was loaded in double-aught buck.
Mm-hmm.
And then the outside part caught the air as it came out.
Mm-hmm.
So this thing, you would bust the M79 round, the sleeve it wouldn't get out there just a little ways. The air stopped it basically as soon as it came out the end of the gun. It was just to transport the buckshot down the center of the barrel. And then the double-aught buck would go on and hit about like a 12-gauge shotgun. And it gave the guy something really good for a point man in the bush,
mm-hmm.
or to bust something close in. And the downside of it was, it was lead. It was basically double-aught buck lead.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the North Vietnamese, and they started screaming that was a cruel and inhumane way to kill somebody, because they're having a lot of guys die from lead poisoning.
Mm-hmm.
So, I never did understand that anyway. I mean, there's no nice, sweet way to kill somebody.
Right.
And I really didn't feel bad about killing that boy. But they replaced that round with a buckshot round that had steel shot. And the steel just wasn't heavy enough.
Right.
And it'd splatter somebody and make them mad and hurt, I'm sure, but it wouldn't knock somebody down like the old double-aught buck lead shot would. The steel shot, after some bad experiences, they quit even ordering the stuff.
Hmm.
They just told them to throw it away, and we didn't put a M79 man on point anymore.
Yeah.
I wish we could have had those.
Hmm.
We did get something I thought was super about September, October of 68. We got M79 illumination rounds the first time. And they were a long white end on the old M79 grenade, and it gave you illuminations. You could go up about 200 or 300 meters with a little parachute illumination, and you could have your own illumination there in with the, you know, each squad did.
Sure, it must have been great instead of waiting for the mortars.
Yeah, yeah, it was great. You didn't have to call artillery or wait for mortars. If you needed illumination really bad, you could pop your own illumination right out there on an ambush or something. And that was really great. Another thing that I found out we had after I got back down at Fort Hood, I was looking at out of boredom. I was on night CQ, and I'd go in there and look at all the classified books and weapons and stuff, and I found out that we had small tactical nuclear mortars. We had all sorts of things that we wouldn't use because it was nuclear weapons. But they also had a gas vapor bomb and even a gas vapor artillery shell, I think, which was, it just exploded and released gas, and then a detonator, when the mixture was just right, would detonate it, and it had concussion that would kill everything down to about 50 meters,
and
tunnels. It would wipe out everything.
Yeah, it looks like we've been using them lately in Afghanistan.
I hope they are. Same thing. Mm-hmm. They tested these things, and they said, oh my God, that's inhumane. Yeah. Because basically, it was the concussion was so severe that in somebody 30 meters down into a tunnel or bunker or something, they would blow up. When the well, they said in this film that the concussion usually stopped their heart, and then the implosion. When the concussion was so severe, when it let off, you would pop.
Yeah.
And it was sounded like a great weapon to me. They never used it in Vietnam, and it would have cleared the tunnels and the spider holes, and boy, it would have been a great weapon. They were scared to use it because it would have been inhumane. I hope we're using it over there now. I think we used it in Iraq.
I believe so. Yeah, I know a little bit about fuel air explosives.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Gas vapor fuel air.
Yeah.
Yeah, the film I saw was unbelievable.
Yeah.
It was a 500 pound bomb, and they dropped it and detonated it in a forest in Georgia. And it cleared the area for about an eighth of a mile around, like the spokes of a wheel. The trees just, they snapped at ground level and just popped onto the ground. It just slammed them down. And it was one of their tests where they had sheep buried in spider holes, which caused another big stink because the Humane Society got involved in it. They killed all these sheep. And that was a weapon I wish they'd have used. We could have cleared areas with that and not had to try to go in there and dig them out of the tunnels. Usually we couldn't find them, and then they would end up ambushing us later, you know.
Yeah, come up behind you. So.
Yeah, they were master little tunnel rats.
Did you get any into a free grenade launchers while you were there? Because I know they were just starting to come in 68. That's the grenade launcher mounted under the
M16. M16?
Yeah.
We had some of those and didn't use them, but we trialed them and didn't like them.
Really?
They had basically, you know, they'd fire an M79 grenade round underneath, I think, in a 3 or 5 shot magazine.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. They were mostly automatic.
This was one of the experimental ones, though.
Yeah. And, yeah, they had just a long magazine. I think it may have been 3 grenade rounds. And in the jungle, they got caught in the weed and the vines and stuff all the time. It was heavy, made it difficult to move. You had 2 weapons to clean instead of one.
Right.
And they jammed quite a bit. And we carried and tried them, selected people. We had maybe 3 or 4 in a platoon.
Right.
And we tried them for a month or so and just did not. We just hated them. They just weren't a good operational weapon in Vietnam. And maybe in the desert or something, they might have been great. But at the time, we just went back to having everybody, each squad, you know, had an M79 Grenadier, and he just carried the old M79. But those didn't work out very good. Some of their ideas worked great, some didn't. We got to watch them test a 7.62mm minigun on the little Loach. And that was interesting. He worked out on a hill there north of Buff. And he came in about 3 times and tested it, and I think they took it off and never tried that again.
Really?
Yeah. But that thing had so much push from the recoil when he, you know, 6,000 rounds a minute.
Yeah.
It did good on the Cobras and all, but they tried it on a little Loach. It was going to turn these Loaches into super gunships, I guess. They fired that thing out of the side, and he started going all over this guy. He couldn't even... Well, he had to shut it down pretty quick, because he's spewing around everywhere. He's coming our way. He's throwing stuff everywhere. Yeah, he couldn't even control it once he opened up that meeting.
God.
So, that didn't work. They did, I guess about by mid-'68, they had some perimeter defense over at Dottie, because it was such a big artillery fire base, and they had a 2,000-gallon J-4 Blimit to refuel helicopters with. It and L.Z. Ross both had big fuel rubber Blimits. And they had a track equipped with a 40-millimeter ACAC. The old dusters, pom-poms.
Yeah.
And over there they had a track with 40-millimeter dusters. And they had a deuce and a half with quad 50s,
mm-hmm.
and they rigged up a 7.62-millimeter minigun on the back of a three-quarter ton.
Mm.
And when those three ripped loose, boy, they tore the world apart.
I can imagine.
They were awesome when they opened up. But they would just float around the perimeter of Dottie, and if one side was in danger of getting run over or something, they just drive over there and blast away, and, you know, the pipe was open. God, it was scary when they let go, get all three of them together. But those worked really good.
Excellent. So, after, I guess you said, 8 months as squad leader, you then became a platoon sergeant?
Well, I was on and off platoon sergeant. Different times. Depend on... We got an older sergeant named Robert.
Mm.
And he was about 35, I guess.
Mm.
And he could even carry a full backpack. Well, he carried his own stuff, but he couldn't carry smokes and claymores and mortar rounds and all the other stuff we carried with, just because of his age. He just wasn't up to it.
Yeah.
And he wasn't really experienced enough to be a squad leader, and he was an E6, so we made him platoon sergeant. And, you know, platoon sergeant is mostly just keeping up with the roster, passing out sea rations, administrative stuff, you know. For a long time there, on and off, I was platoon sergeant and squad leader both. I just did both jobs when I needed to.
Mm-hmm.
For about 3 weeks, when Muff got, I was in the hospital, I was, for about 3 weeks there, I was squad leader, platoon sergeant, platoon leader, both.
Wow.
All day. I mean, acting platoon leader.
Huh.
Yeah, I was still Spec 4 then.
Hmm.
So I got to be all three for a while.
Wow.
That wasn't that much fun. I didn't like being platoon leader.
But how many guys did you have under you at that point?
We normally... We're able to keep about 18 to 25 guys in platoon.
Really?
In third platoon.
Wow.
I can remember getting down to 12 or 13 once or twice, and I can remember having like 28 or so a couple of times. But normally we run around 22 to 25 men.
Wow.
We're able to keep that many in the field. So, which we thought we was really had a lot of people if we could get 25 people in platoon. You know?
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we never did get even close to what the Army considered a standard fighting unit, you know, which was... Well, a standard fighting unit would have been like a 12-man fire team,
right,
and two in a squad.
Mm.
And then you would have three squads. You know, you had a platoon nearly 100 people.
Mm.
Well, that was about the size of our company normally.
Mm.
We run 70 to 100 people in Charlie Company.
Wow.
So we just couldn't keep that many people out in the field all the time.
Mm.
And constantly getting new people, somebody being on R&R, somebody wounded, you know, just never could keep that many people out in the field.
So how was it accepting new people into your squad?
Well, I was always glad to see new people come in because it's always needing people.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, everyone, I had a squad with quite a few experienced people, thank goodness, and everyone tried to help the new guys learn what was going on as fast as, you know,
right,
train them as fast as could, hoping that they'd become experience.
Mm.
And unfortunately, most of the new guys didn't last anywhere from a day to 2 months. You know, they just didn't. It was hard to get new guys trained enough to get them experienced enough to last.
Mm.
But they were accepted real good. One thing I know was true, even in my case as a squad leader, you didn't get close buddies with a new guy until he was there at least 2 or 3 months.
Mm.
But they just didn't last.
Mm.
And that kind of made it tough on the new guys too. I was one at the time, and you know, your first thought is, well, do I have a plague?
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody wants to chum around or be buddies much with me. Well, they all scared you fixing getting blown away.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to kind of get over about a 3-month hump. But Now, we was always glad to see new guys because we was always needing personnel. And even if all they knew was to follow around and shoot the rifle, you know, that was a help. We seemed like we had a lot of turnover in new guys.
Mm-hmm.
They always had a core of old guys that seemed to last.
Mm-hmm.
I think from our experience, and at least in our company and our platoon, the new guys were really welcomed. I was always glad. I guess we were real fortunate. The guys in third platoon were a real close bunch of guys. You know, it's all buddies, and it's kind of like a family.
Mm.
And my buddy in Kentucky, he remembered once he and I were doing something. We were squad leaders, and I guess we'd been to a briefing or something. I don't know what we were doing. It was on a fire base. Mail arrived, you know, and we were a close enough platoon that the mail arrived. If somebody wasn't there, we'd read the mail for them, you know. We'd let them know what it said when they got there.
Mm.
But, you know, if you didn't get your mail first and open it, it'd probably be somebody else reading it, you know.
Hey, you know, what's going on home?
Well, Jerry and I got back over there, and the whole squad was, well, the whole platoon was eating cake. And, you know, we were lucky. A cake that got there was usually about a week old, but still tasted good.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's kind of half squished. A lot of times they never got there. Fresh powder cake, if the guys in the rear, you know, could smell it,
mm-hmm.
they knew what it was. They'd open it and eat it, and they'd never make it to the field.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, the guys were sitting around eating cake. And we walk up, and somebody said, "Hey, Jerry, you know, Gary, we saved you a piece of cake. Grab a piece of cake." We thought, "Oh, this is great, you know." One of them said, "Happy birthday, Jerry."
it was Colin's birthday.
He said, "Your aunt sent you a nice cake. Wrote a nice note, too." They'd already opened opened little care package. And
luckily for us, they at least saved us a piece of cake
for Jerry's birthday.
That's funny. Was there a lot of, I guess, rear echelon tampering with the mail and stuff like that?
Not so much with the mail, but packages.
Mm.
And I don't know if it was our company people or if it was battalion or just the mail, Army mail in general.
Mm.
But yeah, a lot of the stuff, we'd get a letter from home or something, you know, and said, "Did you enjoy the pie we sent last week? Did you get it?" You know, now we probably got one out of 10, maybe cookies, anything that could be smelt or they could figure out it was a good cake or pie or something, never make it out there.
Mm.
Now we didn't have a real good relationship, I guess you could say, with the rear echelon base camp commandos, because we thought they lived a luxury life, and they seemed to always have things we didn't.
Mm.
You know, they took advantage of the situation, I guess you'd say.
Right.
We went once during the monsoon season, was trying to get poncho liners. And those things were fantastic because they'd keep you warm even when they were wet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the camouflage poncho liner.
Yep.
God, that was the best thing the military had, was a poncho liner.
Right.
We couldn't get any.
Really?
Finally found out they had got a big supply the last month before. Our supply sergeant back there had given them to his girlfriend down in Anton.
Jeez.
So they all went on the black market, you know. And a lot of the stuff that should have been out there, except for, ordnance and weapons, a lot of it, I think, ended up being sold or given to the villagers by one of the rear echelons.
Mm-hmm.
And then one time we got a big weapons cache. We found way over 100 mostly bolt action little carbine and SKS rifles, but they were decent rifles.
Mm-hmm.
And we tagged them all. Tagged one for Colonel Stinson, and then the captain got first choice, and we just worked our way down, you know, by rank and privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody tagged one, and the captain called our armor back in bayonet, told him they was on the way in, and the colonel knew about them. They were, we got a count of what they were for intelligence and all, and they were supposed to go in and fill out the paperwork for us, because we tagged every one of them with their name and all this stuff, and they were supposed to register them so we could bring them home. We had a nice bolt-action SKS souvenir.
Mm.
Well, about half of them got retagged on LZ Professional when the chopper stopped on Professional And they took some pictures and stuff. I got a picture on the internet from Alpha Company.
Mm.
One of the guys in Alpha Company took a picture of the weapons cache. And about half of them disappeared unprofessional or re-tagged.
Mm.
They got back to bayonet, and I think only Captain Hall was the only one that got a rifle.
Wow.
The colonel, the captain, they were all the rest of them out to base camp commandos.
Mm.
They registered them for themselves and sent them home.
Wow.
They just took advantage of the situation they were in back there, did things we couldn't do. Mm-hmm. You know, they could go to the PX and buy stereo systems, you know, a key systems, real cheap and all. We didn't even have a chance to go to the PX. And,
mm-hmm.
and because of things like that, there were just some kind of hard feelings.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't real popular with us.
Imagine.
And every once in a while, especially Captain Sorensen, who was a young German, we'd get on a firebase, we paid $6 a month, or everybody chipped in, to buy beer for stand down or something. And he'd call in and say, you know, we got 70 people on the firebase, I want 70 beers. Well, we'd get Ballantine or something. You go back there to Bayonet, and in the supply room, they had stacks of Budweiser and Coors.
Hmm.
They drank the Bud and Coors, and they sent us out the Ballantine junk, you know.
Hmm.
So we just didn't have real warm feelings towards the base camp commanders. And of course, they kept their distance from us. We usually came in from the field. We'd been out there for 2 weeks, and we'd grungy and smelt, and they all kept their distance from us, and that was fine with us.
Now, I was reading in the after-action report that you had given us.
Burlington Trail?
Yeah. Yeah. At one point, Charlie, 1st and 52nd, was up on to 1st of the 1st Cav.
Yeah.
Were you actually working with the 113th?
Yeah, that was F Troop.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, the 1st and the 1st Cav was F Troop track unit.
Okay.
They was, you know, I think they had two tanks. They could never seem to get out there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they get buried in rice paddies. The tanks were... The track units weren't real good in Vietnam, and tanks were almost worthless.
Mm.
You know, they couldn't push their way through the jungle. They couldn't get through elephant grass even. They'd go out in rice paddies. They'd bury up. They'd try to go down the highway or something. They'd blow the whole track off in a Russian landmine.
Yeah.
Tanks just weren't worth much in Vietnam.
Mm.
The track units, they got by, except that they drew a lot of fire.
Mm.
But we were up there working with F Troop.
Mm.
And they got an F Troop from the first Cav. We worked with them and H Troop, which was the 17th Cav, I think.
Mm.
You probably read some stuff in there about H Troop.
Yes.
They were in almost mirror image each other.
Mm-hmm.
F Troop worked more closer up to Da Nang around Tam Kỳ and all. We worked mm-hmm. a lot with them. Once we went back south of July, down around Buff and all, we was back to working with H Troop, the 17th Cav.
Right.
But you ever watch F Troop on TV?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that these guys.
Same kind of outfit.
Same bunch. I swear, they transported those guys from the television program to July and put them in tracks. They were the same bunch of guys. God, they couldn't do anything.
It's funny.
You know, they had for the colonel, you know, we're sending you out to help take this certain hill. And the captain would say, we don't need them. Keep them at home. Well, they had to have something to do, I guess. First thing you know, there they were, and we were out there to meet them.
Uh-huh.
You know, you had to watch them. Well, they'd run over you. They didn't pay any attention to infantry guys. You had to watch them constantly just to not get run over.
Mm.
And then they drew all the fire.
Mm.
At one hill, they called us and got to go help F Troop, you know. Well, what's the problem? Well, they've been up this hill 3 times and get driven back off, you know. So, you know, Captain Hall says, well, send them somewhere else. We'll go take the hill. No, they'll be there to support you. They had 50 calibers and stuff, and they had a lot of firepower, but good Lord, we just didn't enjoy working with H Troop. F Troop, H Troop either.
Mm.
And all my guys, I left on the 6th of June. We had a platoon. My buddy in Kentucky had just got hurt, and he would never go back. He had 2 months left, and he got shot in the leg and all that.
Mm.
He spent his last 2 months around Bayonet. And I left the platoon with my squad, with Billy Chenault, and the platoon out there. And they were all, they had anywhere from 3 to 7 months. They were pretty experienced platoon.
Mm.
The 3rd platoon was a bunch of veteran people. And I thought, well, they're all going to be okay. You know, I didn't feel quite so guilty about going home, just leaving them there.
Mm.
But I got a letter from Billy Chenault on the 23rd. And a week after I came home, they were working with H Troop, Cav Unit, and been working with them about a bunch for the last 2 months down there. They could work around those rice paddies and all down there south of July. It wasn't in the jungle mountains. And one of them ran over a Russian anti-tank mine, I think, and wounded about half a platoon. So about half the guys I knew were gone within a week after I was there. I found out, I think they all they just major wounds. They went to Japan for about a month and they came home. Wow. So none of them got killed. And then on the 19th, they were riding back to the night perimeter with H Troop. They'd been out taking the hills or something, and they were supposed to go set up a night perimeter somewhere else, and our platoon jumped on a couple of tracks, you know, and just were riding with them, and they just turned into this night perimeter, and Bill Oberle, who was at our reunion, he was with them, and he remembered well enough up until the thing blew up. He remembered it until it detonated what went on. But he said they pulled up there and stopped, and there was, you know, one of the ammunition cans. You get like M16 ammunition, a little square can with a lid. The lid was laying there on the ground, which they all thought was pretty curious. So the track commander, you know, he tells the driver, he said, check that out. Well, he climbs up out of the hatch, you know, the driver's hatch, and jumped off the track and jumped right on top of it. And it was a pressure release device on top of a what they think was about a gallon of explosives. You know, it was about the size of a gallon drum. And killed him and wounded the rest of the platoon.
Wow.
The only one left out there was Billy Chenault. And he lost his hearing, I think, in one ear completely for about a month and a half or so. And Billy had 82 days left, I think. And I don't think Billy ever went back out either. So within 2 weeks, thanks to H-Troop, the whole platoon was wiped out.
Wow.
And the same day, in a separate incident, our Captain Hawk, Captain Manchester, he got shot through the butt with a .51 caliber. And when I heard that, I figured it tore his legs off. That usually, a .51 usually takes a limb. If you if you survive it, it takes something off.
Yeah.
But Jerry Collins was still over there, and he jumped in the Jeep and headed over there, and saw him when he came out of surgery, and it went right through his butt, missed his hip bones, and just tore his butt up real bad.
Wow.
So within 2 weeks there, everybody I knew, including the captain, was McDaniels was hit in that second time with a piece of shrapnel in his lung and deflated his lung. And so the lieutenant, the captain, everybody was gone within 2 weeks. And just didn't like working with the tracks. They were bad news.
That's
far as I was concerned.
Now, the guys in your platoon, were they mainly draftees, or were there any regular Army guys? Or?
Except for the officers. I can only remember one guy in our company who was regular Army, RA. And he was a crybaby, because he signed up to be radar or something. And they, you know, what they promise you. And what a lot of people didn't figure out, you could join up for 4 years or something. They finally lowered it, you could join up for only 3 years. Well, you could join up, and they promised you a certain MOS in the school. They didn't promise you wouldn't be an infantry.
Right.
I mean, you would think once you got all this training that would you would end up at that. But he was a trained radar operator or something, and they got over there and they were full, so they sent him out to Charlie Company. You know, everyone in the Army, just like the Marine Corps, basic MOS is 11B. So he was a whiner, you know. He didn't get any sympathy. But he joined. But about 99% of the company was draftees, except for a few of the officers. And most of those guys were ROTC or something, and they were pretty much draftees too. Not many of them stayed in. Just the captains, I guess. Most of them are career.
Yeah.
And one of our better captains was the German Sorensen. He came up from the 11th Brigade, and he came up from a rifleman, and he went up to an acting platoon leader, and they gave him a field commission as a first lieutenant. And then after 6 months, I think, as a platoon leader in the 11th Brigade, he came to Charlie Company as a first lieutenant, as our company commander, and he was a second first lieutenant, I think, for a month or two, and they made him He finally got promoted to captain. But he came up through the ranks as an NCO. And he was pretty gung-ho. I think he was only 20 years old.
Wow.
And he was going to make a career of the military.
Yeah.
And one of the guys from Washington, Ron Vandenberg, had got a letter from him about 10 years ago, and he only stayed in about 5 or 6 years and got out. I think his year and a half of Vietnam kind of wore him out. He was gung-ho when he first got to us, and I think by the time he was a captain for 6 months, he was getting really tired. It wasn't fun anymore. And I heard a lot of them, I don't know if it happened to Sorensen, but I heard that a lot of the field promotions, when you came back stateside, they switched you back to an E6 or an E7.
Yeah.
You didn't get to keep your field promotion because you weren't trained as an officer and a gentleman.
Right.
And which I think was an atrocity, because that was probably some of the best commanders they had.
Mm.
But I heard that happen quite a bit.
I heard a terrible story relating that guy. Yeah, he was a platoon sergeant in B Troop 17th Cav. And he had been in Korea, got a field promotion, made it to major, made it to captain, and was passed over 3 times for promotion to major.
Mm-hmm.
And they knocked him back down to an E6.
Mm-hmm. Got his field promotion.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know they did that.
Yeah.
Muff, who was our acting platoon leader for 4 or 5 months, and an assistant, tried to train about 3 lieutenants.
Mm-hmm.
They offered Muff a field commission, and he didn't even talk about it.
Really?
He said, "A year's all I can take. You know, I'm going home."
Did they offer you one as acting platoon leader?
No. No, I wasn't. I was only acting platoon leader for about 3 weeks because Muff was actually wasn't wounded. He went down to Anton many times. He had Meniere's disease at Shankroy, and that cured him of going to the village. So I can tell you, three weeks in the hospital, and they got it cured up, and he didn't even want to look at a man of these women anymore.
Man.
But they didn't make me any offers. They tried to get me to re-up once. That'd be insane. They said, "We could get you a job as a truck driver or a cook." I said, "No way." I'm going to go home. I get out of here, I'm going home.
Yeah.
But one of my friends at work, he got drafted, and he got to spend his time in Germany. He was lucky. And his captain over there in Germany was a second lieutenant in Vietnam, and his first sergeant in Germany with E7 was a captain in Vietnam. And the same thing happened to them.
Wow.
The guy spent a year and a half in Vietnam and was field promoted up to a lieutenant first and then a captain, and he got a captain and had his second lieutenant, well, his first lieutenant, one of the platoon leaders, was there, and they went from Vietnam to Germany. And when they rotated him to Germany, they busted him back to an E7. And he made fast promotion up to E7, but they took away his field permission when they sent him to Germany, and his first lieutenant, who was a platoon leader there with him, was promoted to captain, and he was a captain in Germany, so they had a role reversal.
Wow.
And Steve said the one thing you didn't do was say anything bad about the first sergeant, because he said you could say about anything you wanted to about the captain, but he would not tolerate anybody bad mouthing or saying anything bad about his first sergeant, who had been his captain in Vietnam, because he thought the world of the guy.
Wow.
He said you want to get in trouble fast, just say something bad about the first sergeant, and boom, he was on rotten duty for the rest of the year too.
Wow.
And they didn't have it. He took care of the complaining real good, quick. That Germany was cold at the time, you know, hot in summer, I guess, and cold. And he said, "Guys would bitch, you know," and he'd say, "Hey, I can have you out of here tomorrow." You don't like Germany, you know. I've got a spot.
Nice warm spot for you.
Nice warm spot for you. I can have you on an airplane tomorrow.
Yeah.
So they didn't have a lot of complaining in the company in Germany. They were a bunch of happy people. But I thought that was kind of an atrocity what they did to those officers.
Yeah.
Field promote them and make them think they were going to be able to stay in as an officer, and then they rotate stateside or something, and then they're back as a sergeant.
Yeah. Especially when you've got combat experienced officers.
Yeah.
So, you know,
probably some of the most experienced and best officers they had.
Yeah. So. Well, we've been going for 2 hours.
Yeah, that was about. I found out well, my buddy in Kentucky had Jerry, who you know, he got wounded just before I came home, and he got ended up with a Silver Star and all that. And he had kind of a tough time with the VA.
Mm.
I didn't mess around with the VA much when I got home. I didn't need to.
Mm.
But he had shrapnel on his leg. He needed to be taken out. He went to the VA, and his records, you know, and got destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So the worst thing, which really didn't go well, was when he got a notice that to come in and talk to the induction board about being drafted. And, you know, and he called him and said, guys, you know, I spent 2 years and then in Vietnam. I got wounded. Is it? You can forget that. And they said, well, we don't have any records that you served. He said, that ain't my problem. Your government employees, if the government lost them, you find them. So, you know, it just, he really didn't cooperate, but he wasn't in a cooperative mood when they mentioned drafting again. So he said a couple of months later, a sheriff who was one of his ex-Boy Scouts came through there and told him he had a warrant for him. He had to go down and talk to the draft board. And Jerry said, you know, I'll talk to him. That ain't a problem. So he said, well, it's tough for him to do because he was a kid that Jerry had kind of raised, you know, as an ex-Boy Scout. And he was the sheriff then. The first thing he did was deputize Jerry to try to keep him out of trouble, maybe. As a sheriff's deputy, he could get away with a lot of things.
Uh-huh.
But he went down there, and they told him, you know, they said, you're going to have to come up with some proof that you were serving the military, or you're going to have to report for induction.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry said, you know, you're government employees. If you lost my records, you find them. I ain't proving nothing. You know, you're going to screw you. They said, well, we'll just put you in prison for a couple of years. And he said, no, you better make it a lifetime. But he said, when I get out, if it's 2 years or 10 years, you know, I'll burn you out of your house and I'll kill you and your family both. He said, I ain't screwing with you. And they asked the sheriff, they said, did you hear that? He said, I was looking out the window. What'd you say? He didn't hear anything.
But what they did, which I think is a true atrocity, somehow they evidently found his records because, you know, after 6 years, you got your permanent, your discharge.
Mm-hmm.
And he got a dishonorable discharge. They somehow, because he threatened them or because something, you know, something they did, the draft board did, they screwed around and got him a dishonorable discharge. Well, his dad, who was a sniper in World War II and landed on the beaches of Anzio, wrote their congressman in Kentucky and their senator both. And they had an investigation, and it ended up they fired two of the people from the draft board, and they got that turned over.
Oh,
so he did get his honorable discharge.
Good.
That would have been...
That's disgusting.
That was...
That's really just disgusting.
An atrocity.
Yeah.
But I was telling Muff about this when I found Muff up there in Chicago. And I knew Muff came from the 11th Brigade. He was infused after about 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And Muff said, well, if Jerry's got problems... He said, I'll call Colin. And I said, you know that Colin Powell? He said, yeah, Lieutenant Powell. He was my lieutenant in the 11th Brigade before I came up to the 198th. He said, Colin's a nice guy. I said, I know Colin's a nice guy, but I think Jerry's, he's okay, you know. We're getting his records restored. He's got an honorable discharge. He said, well, that ain't right. He said, I'll write Colin. He said, I'll write Colin, and Colin will take care of this. And I said, you really know Colin Powell? And he said, people don't believe that. I saw him about 3 years ago. He remembers me. I was a squad leader for him in Vietnam. He said, Colin can help. He's a nice guy. And I think Colin's busy.
Just a little right now.
Yeah, he's a little busy right now. He said, he'll take the time.
Wow.
Yeah, and he probably would.
Yeah.
He'd probably do anything for Muff. But hey, we don't have to get Colin involved in this. We're getting some action.
That's great.
And our... a captain that was at our Charlie Company reunion, he was captain after I left.
Mm-hmm.
I left in June and he got there late August,
mm-hmm.
I guess. Yeah, late August. The captain Manchester got shot through the butt, 51 caliber. They got a new captain and he lasted, they said, 4 hours.
Wow.
And somebody stepped on another big booby trap, killed him and about 30 guys.
Wow.
And in fact, they said it was an officer from Delta Company that stepped on the booby trap.
Hmm.
Since he was a brand new officer and brand new captain, they loaned this supposedly experienced lieutenant from Delta Company over there for about a week, and he stepped on a booby trap.
Hmm.
So Terry Garden took over after that, and he told Jerry to help him get his records established and all that, that he would call one of his lieutenants from Vietnam
And Terry Gardner was a captain over there, and he retired as a full bird colonel about 3 years ago. And he said all of his promotions, every time he talked to the board and he put in for promotion, he said it always went back to his experience at Charlie Company. And so he credited Charlie Company with his success. He was West Pointer. And evidently a great guy, because the guys loved him, and we didn't love all our captains. They just loved Terry Gardner. So he must have been a great captain. And he said he'd call his lieutenant, which is a brigadier general now in the Pentagon, and he said, I'll just call him and tell him about your, you know, he took Jerry's name, his address, social security, and all this stuff, you know, and he said, call him, and he said, we'll go from the top down. He said, things move faster that way, which I'm sure is true.
Absolutely.
You know, you get the Pentagon involved, and it's going to be a lot faster than working from the Kentucky VA up. So I think Jerry's getting some accelerated action on his benefits and stuff, which I hope is true.
Great.
He certainly hadn't been treated right for the last 31 years.
So would you like to keep going?
No, I guess I better head back to work and check things out and get to the house, I guess.
Okay. All right. So I guess we'll formally end this. This concludes the interview with Mr. Gary Franklin.